Thank you for downloading the IA podcast. The episode you're about to listen to was originally featured as a video on the IA's YouTube channel, IA London. But we've taken the audio and we've turned it into a podcast so that you can listen on the go. Enjoy.
Hello again, friends. How are you doing? Hope things are going well for you. Thanks for tuning in to another episode of The Swift Path with Snowden. I'm not going to mess around with any lengthy introductions. Let's get straight into it. You know the drill. We've got half an hour to talk about whatever we want to talk about. And my very special guest this week is Madeleine Grant, who is the parliamentary sketchwriter at The Telegraph. Madeleine, how are you doing? Thanks for joining us.
Very well. Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Are you feeling chirpy and cheerful at the moment, or are you, like me, rather depressed and grumpy?
I'm never that cheerful these days, what with politics being what it is, but I think I'm probably a bit jollier than you today, if that's any consolation.
The COP26 thing has depressed me much more than I thought it would. I think partly because I didn't realise it was going to be a fortnight, a solid 2 weeks. I assumed it would be like, maybe my median guess would have been 3 days.
Well, yeah, I was surprised by it. I was also surprised by the length of it. I think that basically the important stuff, the grandstanding bit where everyone comes in, speeches, that's kind of the first couple of days. And that bit is already over. I think Boris has left. It's now Rishi taking the centre stage. And there was hardly anyone watching the centre stage this morning. So in a way, I'm quite happy about COP because it's clearly been such an absolute fiasco. There's been so many logistical problems leading up to it. The city of Glasgow seems to be an absolute carnage, rats and bins overflowing and the trains not working and the overpriced Airbnbs and all that jazz. So in a way, I'm quite happy because there has been a lot of alarmist rhetoric coming out of COP, but it doesn't really seem to have landed. You know, it keeps saying things like 1 minute to midnight, and yet nobody really seems to be particularly interested in it, which to me, that makes me feel quite cheerful.
The media are very interested in it, aren't they? My policy was treated like the Olympics and trying to avoid watching a single second of it, which I did succeed with this year with the Olympics. But I thought I'd better watch the news last night, partly because I was going to speak to you. I thought I'd better have some idea of what was going on. And the ITN news was a good 20 minutes on COP and then another couple of stories and then back to more stuff about COP. And whatever her name is, the presenter, was there in some rather shabby-looking exhibition centre. And then Robert Peston came on, as he always does on ITN News. As I don't watch it every night by any means, I watch it occasionally, but he's always on, isn't he? As if he's some great oracle, and he turns up, and he looked particularly shabby yesterday. His kind of his jacket turned up like this. He looked pissed, which, to be fair, he probably was. It was 10 o'clock, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. But he came on and gave his opinion about climate change, which had clearly just been cribbed off the back of an envelope. I don't know where I'm going with this. I'd like to talk about Robert Peston actually and his mysterious career, but I guess the main point is the media are obsessed with it, especially Sky, because they've got their little climate show every day. You think people in general are not?
Well, I think people are interested in climate change, in the environment, definitely, but I just don't think they're as interested as the politicians and the media would like them to be. And then no matter how much they continue this campaign, it doesn't really seem to filter through. I think it was Guido did some analysis of this recently. You know, Sky has that special environmental show that they do in the morning. I think it's like during the Kay Burley show, there's a segment on environmentalism every day. And they looked at the viewing figures. It just absolutely tanks during that period. And then it picks up again. Right. When it's over. You know, people say they're interested in the abstract, but just not at the level of climate catastrophe that you see on the media.
I would be interested to know how many viewers their daily climate show gets, because what's in a daily climate show? The whole point about climate change is it's incremental and you can't really attribute any one event to climate change per se. I might have to tune in and see what they are reporting on that.
Well, actually, it's true. I've never watched, which is bad. Yeah. I should have, but I think actually part of the reason is that level of, I was thinking about this the other day, Boris Johnson was asked about recycling and it was, I think he was speaking to a panel of kids, which is the way that we talk about environmental issues now. There always has to be a child on stage. He was talking to the kids And he was, someone said something about recycling, and he basically said, recycling is not the answer. The answer is to use less plastic. Recycling barely does anything, which is quite, I don't know, it makes you feel, it makes the viewer feel like there's nothing much that we can do. And then you know perfectly well that China and Russia are not attending this conference. China's building new power stations all the time. So I think there's an element of, it feels really big and important, but also we feel like all the solutions are beyond our control. So why, what can we do? Why, it's sort of taken out of the human scale that makes stories interesting to people.
Right. Yeah. And but he do. Boris Johnson sort of had a point, didn't he, about recycling not being the answer to climate change. It hasn't really got anything to do with climate change at all. It's just a nice thing to do to save waste, but the rubbish only goes in landfill otherwise. So people sort of think that recycling, because it's a nice thing to do and it's a relatively easy thing to do, they're doing their bit for the environment, and they are in one respect, but it's got nothing to do with climate change, is it?
Oh yeah, no, of course not. But I just think it's, I don't know, there's people care a lot about their local environment, and there's a lot that people can do locally. And I think it's kind of a bit, I don't know, damaging to kind of downplay the things that people can actually do that are within their control. Because otherwise it just becomes this kind of national hair shirt exercise. And ultimately, so any kind of solution rests in the hands of politicians and trying to get somehow try to get the big emitting countries around the world to sign up to stuff. And actually, yeah, it's not tackling climate change in quite the same way. But I think an awful lot of people care desperately about their local environment and their kind of conservation and these sorts of things. I think it's a bit of a danger to kind of downplay those sorts of efforts.
Well, particularly since the things that really make a difference to climate change are just so unpopular with voters, and a lot of them just can't be done. I mean, this is what sort of depresses me about the COP thing, because it's symptomatic of a broader problem, which is, you mentioned the rats running around Glasgow, right? You know, the politicians can't do basic things. They can't provide enough hospital beds. They can't get the bins collected, but they think they can control the temperature in 80 years' time. And that's the thing they're really focusing on. You know, we seem to have these sort of political pygmies with incredible delusions of grandeur. And it's not just climate change, it's very other massive issues. They think they can take on these huge issues when they can't even do the small things correctly.
100%. The whole thing of COP, you've got this extraordinary kind of panorama. It's almost like something from revolutionary France or like Iran, just like, it's like that giant party in the desert that the Iranians had right before the revolution. You know, there's the city going to the dogs, and then you've got all these world leaders coming in, but not the ones that we actually really need to be there, just the grandstanding ones, and burning, you know, huge amounts of fuel in order to get there. And then there's a kind of fundamentally unserious discussion where there's a lot of cozying up to children and celebrities and actors, and it's all a bit Team America. And ultimately, you know, I don't think anyone really believes much, anything really significant will come out of this. And if something significant does come out of it, it's likely to actually be the kind of smaller scale stuff that is within our control and not the grandstanding pie in the sky stuff that isn't.
It's most likely to be countries like the US, the UK, kind of just volunteering to commit economic suicide, while the, you know, middle income countries, China and Brazil and Russia and India, just laugh up their sleeves. That's what worries me. It seems like, and I'm not taking a climate denial position here, it just seems we're doomed either way, really, right? If the lights of Greta Thunberg are anywhere near correct, then we're doomed. But the cure seems almost as bad as a disease. I just don't see how anything's going to improve from this point on.
Yeah, I also don't feel the process that they're using to try to figure out solutions is one that's that has given rise to good outcomes before. I think I really like Bjorn Lomborg's point about this, that the way that we get to solve big problems of mankind in previous generations was through some new innovation. You know, that they were, all the Victorians were hunting whales in the Atlantic because they needed the oil to burn lamps. And then the thing that saved the whales wasn't banning the activity, it was inventing kerosene so that then they could fuel their lamps a different way. It's that kind of thing. But I think we're just going about it in completely the wrong way. And often doing things like the government picking losers in the energy industry, giving loads of money to things like biomass, like the Drax power station that burn huge amounts of fossil fuel. And it's not at all clear that it takes decades for that to be offset. And yet that is the single biggest power station or unit that get a recipient of public money. So it just suggests that they pick losers, and they go about this in quite a kind of anti-innovation, anti-ingenuity way. Whereas I actually really like the Prince William's Earthshot Awards, because that was a prize, and the idea that they came up with was, I thought, pretty cool. It's that kind of thing that will get us out of the problem, not the kind of forcing everyone to live a more prehistoric way while the world carries on as normal.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's technology is going to get us out of it if it does, but the technology doesn't currently exist, and it's good that people are given incentives to inventors to come up with something. But at the moment, we've got like this supposedly legally binding target. I don't even understand how that works. We've got a legally binding target, net zero by 2050. And it's entirely based on miraculous leaps in technology coming forth when all these politicians will be long gone. A lot of them will be dead, won't have to carry the can for it. And it just seems to me that, you know, Boris's optimism is quite an appealing characteristic in some ways, but you can't base legally binding targets and a whole system of government on blind optimism.
No, you can't. But I think because of the rhetoric around it, we're only just now beginning to grasp what the likely cost is going to be and how it's going to impact our lives. There's always see interesting polling on this that suggests that people really like net zero in the abstract, but then they also say things like, I'm happy with net zero. Would you be willing to pay an extra £5 a week in tax to pay for it? No. Yeah. I mean, what do you think? Who's going to pay for it? It's that whole like someone else is doing it thing, or the idea that the government's money is somehow different from the tax that we all have to pay.
Yeah.
I feel like there's still a lot of this cognitive dissonance, but it can only last for so long, because at some point the actual nuts and bolts, the bands will start to come in. It will become near enough that it will feel like a real prospect. And then I think you'll see more resistance to it.
Yeah, exactly. I think you'll also see a lot more sort of climate change denial as well, because we sort of saw that with COVID, right? When COVID first came around, there wasn't really anybody denying that it was a problem. It was only when you start bringing in massive restrictions, people start going, oh, hang on, let's have another look at this. Yeah. Maybe it's not true. So I think you'll see, including from probably the same kind of people as well. I noticed Toby Young's blog has started doing more and more stuff skeptical about climate change. One more question about COP before we move on.
Yeah.
Why are there so many speeches? I thought this was going to be about hard negotiation. Maybe it wouldn't take 2 weeks if they didn't have endless speeches. Isn't everyone supposed to sort of basically know what's going on? It's a matter of sitting down and banging some tables. Why is it even in Glasgow? Why don't they just go to the United Nations building in New York, sit down, hammer this out over 2 or 3 days? And usually with negotiations, a negotiation is done before the event. The event is just there to sort of shake hands in it. So why all these endless speeches from these people?
You know, I have no idea, but I suspect that probably some of it has to do with the fact that there are all these visiting dignitaries. And with the advent of social media, every one of them will be eager to get their speech. They can get their clip that they share on their social media. It has become more of a personality exercise. I think social media has probably made these things even more self-absorbed than they were before. As for the negotiation part, yeah, it does seem an odd order to do it in. I suppose they want to, for the schedules of the more important people at the conference, get that out of the way first. And then probably after they've gone, the people come and do the actual grunt work, the actual discussions, the actual look at the deforestation agreements and all that kind of thing. And I suppose it's that they'll probably get all the important people done first, get the royals out of the way, and then get down to business.
I hope so. That's an encouraging thought. The speeches are going to start fading away now. But I suspect there's just going to be more and more celebs coming to give speeches. I see Leo DiCaprio was knocking up yesterday.
I honestly don't know how much people would be interested if it weren't for the royal family being there. Rishi Sunak's speech this morning, hardly anyone was watching, and he's supposed to be one of the more important figures of the conference. I find it very baffling.
Yeah, well, I pity you if it's part of your job to have to watch any of this, to be perfectly honest, because 5 minutes of the news last night was enough for me. Let's talk about something equally depressing, the economy, the British economy, and indeed the world economy. Here's a hypothesis for you. We've got inflation. I think inflation is going to be sticking around for some time, probably creating a sort of spiral of wage demands, which will lead to further inflation. Interest rate rises are on the way. I think they're talking about a mere 0.15% at the moment, which is obviously not going to touch the sides of this problem. But they're going to have to go up, assuming inflation stays high. That's going to mean people have got bigger mortgage payments, their money's going to go less far, people have less disposable income, that'll lead to recession, that'll lead to unemployment, and the whole 2020s are going to be even worse than the previous decade. Have you got a cheerier hypothesis than that? Because I think we're doomed, pretty much. And I've been saying this for over a year now, if not 45 years, but particularly in the last year.
I'm inclined to agree. The one thing that brings me, I don't know, it's not really any joy. It's no joy at all. But I think if people can realise that Johnsonomics, where you promise everything, you promise tax cuts and more spending, and it's cakeism, okay, we're for cake, we're for eating cake, we're for cake everywhere. If people realise that that's not practical, at some point someone has to pay for things, perhaps that will cause a change of direction in politics. You have to hope that it does. But I hope that we don't get to a situation that we've had before, where it has to get so bad before, someone steps in to save the day, Mrs. Thatcher. I hope we don't have to wait. Don't have to get into that kind of dire straits before people, before there is a realization that this kind of cloud cuckoo land economics isn't sustainable.
I think there's a danger though that there will be a political shift, but it'll be in the totally wrong direction. It'll be towards the far left, because I mean, the Tories have been in charge for 11 years. There's this idea, which has become pretty much mainstream now, that austerity was a political choice rather than, a fairly half-hearted attempt to balance the books. People aren't used to high interest rates. They're not even used to normal interest rates, and they're not used to normal rates of inflation either. So the British economy, and particularly the housing market, as well as public sector finances, depend on low interest rates. And every lever has been pulled now to try and keep the economy afloat, and there's nothing left. There's no way left to deal with what is actually quite a belated surge of inflation. So I just think it's over.
Yeah, that's true. Although I do think that what we're seeing now is a fundamental shifting of a kind of shifting of power and influence from once again to the kind of vested interest groups that are holding the country to ransom in various ways. And I think that that does have an impact on how people see things. If they see that there's constant striking and they can't get a doctor's appointment and all this kind of thing, even the GPs are getting some flack from members of the public who are saying, well, it's not some kind of weird eccentricity that I would like to have a doctor's appointment. It's actually something I pay for, thanks. So perhaps that you might see a public backlash in that sense as well.
The BMA, that would be fantastic, because they're really doubling down on this, aren't they? They're telling GPs to go on strike if the government asks them to see, physically examine patients.
And whatever the government suggests, even if it's something, I don't know how good an idea it was. They were talking about having league tables that would rank, I think it was going to rank surgeries according to how many patients they saw. But that's not exactly, some absolutely mega upheaval of what they were doing, but they made it seem as if they were being browbeaten and bullied using, the language of massive victimization. And it looks as if the health secretary has already had to backlash on that quite moderate thing. So I don't know how much hope there is of fundamental reform, but I think you might see more public anger at the fact that their taxes are, they're being taxed more than ever before, but it seems to be going nowhere. And people are very angry about things like waste and the level of service they get. So that could, if it was managed by a charismatic politician and managed well, I think that could translate into something more persuasive. But you're right, it could just go the other way and to further and further left.
Well, the only thing that would help sort the health service out is its privatization, and that's just never going to happen, certainly not for the next 50 years. I mean, it doesn't matter how much money we throw at it and how angry people are at the rubbish service they get, it's literally the most popular thing that's ever happened in this country, the creation of the NHS. Do you see that survey recently? It was above standing alone against Hitler in 1940, above any kind of invention, anything. It was the most popular thing, with like 80% of the population worship the NHS. So that's just going to continue being a money pit, whatever you or I think about it. And that's obviously a very major source of government expenditure. I just think it comes back to what you were saying before, really, about how we've got fundamentally unserious people in charge, and not just in charge, but everywhere, at the universities, in business,
In journalism as well.
In journalism, especially. Yeah. Coming back to, which reminds me of Robert Peston. How I don't understand how somebody like him is probably one of the most highly paid journalists in the country. He doesn't know anything, as far as I can tell. I mean, he literally doesn't know anything more than the man in the pub. And yet he's on the news every night. He's like the guest star. He comes in, they read the news out. Then now let's see what Robert Peston thinks. And he slumps in his chair and talks in that weird... How can you be a broadcaster when you can't speak properly, for one thing? And then he goes on Twitter talking absolute nonsense about COVID, especially. He just flings his hand grenades onto Twitter on like on a Friday afternoon, getting something totally wrong about the stats, and then logs off, never apologizes, never retweets any corrections or anything. I know it sounds like I'm having a personal go at him, and I am, but I guess he's kind of symbolic of a wider problem in journalism.
Kind of, you want to be tough on Peston and tough on the cause of Peston as well.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, I see that. And I think there's a huge asymmetry between how wrong people are allowed to be on Robert Peston's side of the argument. And on the other side of the argument, you know, people can be discredited, smeared for making mistakes about the data. And to be honest, the virus has been so confusing and contradictory that established knowledge has changed very, very quickly. And almost everyone's been wrong about something in a big way. But instead, it hasn't prompted the kind of the level of humility that it probably people have had their careers ruined on one side. And then on the other side, people can just keep getting invited on the Today programme like nothing ever happened, keep being treated like oracles with no obvious soul searching required. It's a curious thing.
Speaking of which, you've been on. Let's talk about your television career, because you've been firstly on Question Time, and also you had a good Mastermind run a while ago. I've never been on Question Time, probably never will. I did go on Any Questions last year, which is less stressful because there's no audience. It was under lockdown. How was Question Time? It looks terrifying to me.
Well, actually, yes, I think you'd be brilliant on Question Time, and I'm sure you will go on at some point. But I actually find Any Questions more stressful when I've done it with an audience, because Question Time actually very thoroughly vet their audience. So they make sure that it's quite an interesting way of doing it. Whatever the country as a whole voted, they make sure that the audience is reflective of the nationwide
general election. Supposedly, yeah.
Yeah. And I know supposedly, but I must say, when I did it, I went to Liverpool and I thought, I remember bringing up my mum, who used to work in TV, and I said, "Mum, they're going to kill me. It's Liverpool. I'm going to have rotten tomatoes thrown at me." And then she said, "Darling, don't worry, because you'll be on with the Tory MP, so they'll go for the Tory MP more." So she said, it's like, imagine the Tory MP is like the gazelle that's been wounded. You just run off and leave them with the carcass. And so quite cutthroat stuff from my nice mum in the countryside. But actually, the Any Questions audience, they don't vet at all. So when I've done that one, it's been absolute carnage, because it was during Brexit. It was during that whole kind of people's vote. So you just get buses of lunatics, weird old people from Bristol, who turn up with their spangled berets, like yelling stuff at you, and no attempt to vet it whatsoever. Whereas Question Time, I was amazed. I managed to get people to clap for privatisation of the NHS in Liverpool, because that's how they vetted the audience.
Oh, really?
Yeah, okay, well, I didn't say privatisation, but
no
reform,
patient-centred healthcare.
Yeah, so that was. I must say, I found it very scary initially, but then once the first question is over, you just glad that went okay, and then you relax a bit. By the end, it was really enjoyed it, but equally, the day before, I couldn't eat. I was so nervous.
Yeah, and how does it compare with Mastermind, stress-wise?
To be honest, I was very lucky with Mastermind, because I just know everything about Harry Potter, because I was just obsessed as a child. And when you read a lot, when you learn something before a certain age, I think it's something to do with how supple your brain is. You basically remember it forever, in the way that if you're fluent at 10, you're fluent for life in a language. But if you learn older, you have to kind of top it up. It's a bit like that. So I kind of barely had to do any work, and I just knew everything about Harry Potter.
And my that was the first round, was it?
Yeah, that was my first round, and my general knowledge wasn't that good. It was just kind of okay, but it was enough because I got all my Harry Potter questions. So I think I was just very lucky there. And then as soon as I got into the next round, where there were people who were kind of properly good quizzes, I just got immediately lost. So I was just lucky that my sort of specialist subject was so I'm amazed they let me do Harry Potter because it's a very popular subject. They've now banned people from ever doing it again because it's been done. Yeah.
And what was the special subject the second time? Jane Austen?
Jane Austen, yeah.
Yeah. And that's when you got knocked out.
I did. I did. Actually, I was winning after the first round because based on Jane Austen. But then the general knowledge questions were harder and the other people were just amazing. So I think I came joint last, all told. But I did enjoy it. And, you know, it's quite scary in the studio. They do things like playing the scary mastermind music in real life just before you go on to kind of set the scene, which I was not expecting.
I've always thought there was a sort of a bit of a mismatch, maybe isn't the right word, but it's kind of inherent unfairness to some of the specialist subjects. Because some people will pick like the First World War and he'll be up against someone who's doing like the third series of Blackadder.
Yeah.
Something like that, you know? And it's like they're not really on a par. You know? I suppose it's a guy's fault for picking such a big subject, but like how narrow can you go with it? Could you have got away with like the first Harry Potter book or something?
No. I think they've got stricter about this now. We used to be a bit easier to narrow it down, but I think they cottoned on to what people were doing. So they were constantly trying to make you do bigger and bigger subjects. And I actually, I think I said I would do this. They were asking me what I wanted to do for my third one if I got into the final, which I knew I wasn't going to get the final. But when I was agreeing it, I said I could do the show Sex and the City. And they said, okay. And I said, can I just do what happens in the show? Because there's so many episodes. And they said, no, you have to do all the actors in every scene, every extra, every setting and all of this stuff. And eventually I just said, well, I'll say yes, but it doesn't mean anything. So it's not like I'm going to get into the final. Whereas my mom went on Mastermind in the noughties and there were people doing really narrow things. I think there was someone doing a like Joan of Arc or someone who died really young.
That's a good idea. Someone who died very young.
Yeah.
Sid Vicious or something like that. That'd be a winner.
Yeah.
We only got 2 minutes left, Mario. I do want to talk to you about James Bond because I know you like myself, you're a big James Bond film. Unlike me, you've watched the new one. I haven't watched it because I know the spoiler and I refuse to give the franchise any of my money. Now I know what they've done to James Bond. Are we allowed to say what happened to him if we give a spoiler alert to our viewers? Do you think?
Yeah, I think as
enough time has passed. Right, there's going to be a spoiler alert, viewers. If you don't want to know what happens in the new James Bond film, turn it off now. So he dies, right? They kill him. Yeah. Well, what the hell is going on?
I'm speechless. When I watched it, I felt like I was watching, you know, it was like being tied to a chair and watching thieves ransack your home and you can't do anything to stop them and they're going through your underwear and taking your jewellery. And I was just like, stop. I'm glad that you haven't seen it because I think you would be angry about a lot more than just that as well. There's this,
really, what else is bad in it?
There's this idea that the love of his life is this really drippy woman who's got like no personality at all. And there's a scene that feels very un-Bond when he actually goes to her house where she lives with this child that she says is not his, but it's clearly him because they have the same eyes. And when he goes to her house, they have a kind of, it's like a kind of IKEA house. And they sort of sit around like having tea and coffee and he makes breakfast for the little kid or whatever. And just not what Bond should be doing. It's so wrong. Like if Bond was a Morris dancer or something, it's not Bond.
Stop getting Bond wrong. Yeah.
Yeah, story of my life.
That's a problem. I think that sums up the general decline of Western civilization. It's also really unimaginative, isn't it? It's like, well, what can we do in this film to really get people's attention? And we'll kill him off. What's the next film going to be?
I hate the way
you only live thrice.
they obviously just think that they are above the franchise, that they can just take all the rules that we've come to know that the fans have accepted for 50 years. And they're just going to torch it all, you know, throw it under the bus because they can. And it's all to give Daniel Craig a send-off because he's special. Yeah. You can't just go and then get someone else in, which is what they've done for everybody else. It's Daniel Craig, so he has to have a special ending with a stupid woke wife.
I hate the way that they've tried to turn it into like a mini series of films and you're supposed to remember what happened in the previous one.
Yeah.
You know, why should I? Why should anyone? This is just, it's just like light entertainment. I have no idea what happened in Quantum of Solace. I'm never going to watch that again.
No, completely.
And you're supposed to remember these people and these, this is a woman from Casino Royale. I don't know who she is. She's just a Bond girl.
Yeah.
What are you talking about?
it's actually a big problem. They think it's very clever and means that you have better plot development. But actually all that happens is you leave the next film burdened with the baggage of the last film, which has to resolve before it can get onto its film, which is why films like Quantum of Solace don't even feel like a proper film, because they spend the first half dealing with the baggage of Casino Royale and you just forget
she
everything.
She can't remember because it was like 4 years previously. I can't remember what happened in there either. I'm not going to keep watching these films. Not even the best ones I've never watched twice.
They are like intellectual yet idiot. They think they know best, and they think that that by shaking things up, they will, you know, prove some grand truth about the series. But all they prove is that actually they're idiots. That the other people had it right, and maybe there was something to this system that had been in place since 1962, and maybe they should have just stuck to that.
There we go. That's a good place to end it. James Bond, a symptom of the general malaise and decline of Western civilization, which I think we can both agree is effectively over. Thanks very much for watching. Hope you've enjoyed it. We'll be back in a couple of weeks. If you'd like to give us some money to the IEA, please do so. It's iea.org.uk/donate. The Patreon, I think, I've got this right now, is patreon.com/IEA London, not /IEA, as I've previously been saying. If you've been giving money to the International Energy Agency or the Islamic Emirates of Afghanistan, try and get a refund, give it to us. The Patreon money goes directly to entertaining, cheerful digital content like this. Madeline, great to talk to you. Take care. Hope to see you in the flesh very soon. Viewers at home, hope to see you digitally very soon. Take care. Goodbye.